wanted to hop on really quick before this episode started and give some trigger warnings. So to start off, in this episode, we talk about fat phobia, racism, eating disorders, systemic racism, verbal violence against Black and brown fat bodies, religious trauma regarding fat phobia, dieting, food apartheid, and ableism. If you've been following us this month, we had two really amazing conversations that centered around intersectionality, and this conversation is going to be all about eating disorders. So as someone who struggles with an eating disorder, I know that that can be really triggering. I want to make sure that you guys are taking care of yourselves and giving yourself space if this is not a conversation that you can be a part of. Additionally, I added some eating disorder resources to my website, so you can go to mindfulmindspod.com/resources to get those. We have everything from hotlines to educational resources to books that we've found helpful. And then lastly, I wanted to give a little bit of a housekeeping update. We made a change on our Instagram, so we are no longer at Serafina Blog. We are now at Mindful Minds Pod on Instagram. I've been wanting to make this change for a while because I haven't really been writing on the blog as much as I used to, and I'll still write, you know, now and again, but I'm primarily focusing on the podcast, so I wanted to make sure that the Instagram reflected that. So you will see that change on the Instagram page, and if you're not following us already, please give us a follow. Other than that, I hope you guys enjoy this episode. It's honestly one of my favorite ones that we've recorded thus far, and I think it's a really educational and insightful conversation, and Brianna has some amazing, amazing, amazing education and resources to share with you guys. Thanks. Hi, all, and welcome back to Mindful Minds. Thank you so much for joining us today. Today, we're going to be chatting about disordered eating, but specifically having an intersectional conversation about disordered eating with Brianna from At The Celestial Life RD. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you? Thank you so much for having me on your podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. We've been trying to make this happen for a while, so I'm so glad we finally made it work.
Yeah, third time's the charm.
Yes. Well, I wanted to give you a space really quick for those who maybe don't know you or your platform. Do you want to talk a little bit about your background and kind of why you started your page?
Sure. So, again, my name is Brianna. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I am a Black cisgendered woman, and I am a registered dietitian. So I got into the field of nutrition kind of in a weird way, I guess you can say. I wanted to go to school for pastry or culinary arts, and my parents were paying for my schooling, and they were like, we're not paying for that. And I was like, okay, cool. They wanted me to have, you know, more of like a typical education than doing just culinary, and they said I can do culinary afterwards if I wanted to. But so my mom suggested nutrition because it's related to food. So I went along with it, and I was just, you know, doing the general nutrition that we all learn in school, which is dieting, full of diet culture, not talking about culture identity and all of those things. Until I was working in a job and I had a lot of free time, I started listening to more podcasts, and I started listening to Food Psych by Christy Harrison, which is an eating disorder podcast. I don't even know how I got into it, but I ended up getting into it, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And I feel like I related to so many of the things that she was talking about on the podcast. So after that is when I finally got started working in eating disorders and disordered eating. So my philosophy is more of anti-diet, all foods fit, weight inclusive. I love to explore weight bias, how all of these intersectional identities impact people in their eating, in their body image. I think also just being BIPOC, being Black, was not something that I talked about or wasn't something that was like really present on my mind for a while, even after I got started in eating disorder treatment. It was when a Black therapist joined the team and she started talking about those issues, and I was like, wow, like I've never thought about anything like this before. And it really opened up my mind to the fact that eating disorder treatment is very white and very thin woman cisgender focused, and there needs to be a lot more work that goes into that. So I started my Instagram page earlier, just focusing on like cooking and baking and all of that stuff, but I transitioned it to a more of talking about BIPOC and the intersections with eating disorders.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I only started doing eating disorder like recovery and like healing in my own life in the last maybe 3 years ish. And I started seeking out, like a lot of people do, like Instagram platforms, for entirely selfish reasons, like just trying to like find resources and healing on my end. And it was one of the things that it kind of shocked me, the lack of inclusivity and the lack of, Black and brown people like being elevated in that space. It was a very whitewashed space and I wasn't entirely expecting that. And didn't even realize it really until we had Megan Watson on the podcast of Thrive with Meg, and she talks a lot about eating disorders on her page. And it was kind of one of those things where when I was seeking people out to talk about eating disorders, I believe she was the first person we had on to talk about eating disorders. And I realized like, yeah, like 90% of it's 90% white people.
Yeah.
And it didn't quite click. And I think like a lot of people, when I grew up in a very religious, fundamentalist, black and white type of environment where there is no gray, there is no nuance, there's right and wrong. And intersectionality is very lost in that type of an environment. And it wasn't until maybe 2 or 3 years into my kind of like renaissance experience of trying to educate myself and like expose myself to just the world, because I'd grown up in such a little tiny bubble, that I realized like, oh, I'm doing all of this in a fundamentalist way. And I'm still staying very black or white. I'm not looking at how other things impact other things. And then my brain exploded because I started like researching specifically testing. We've talked about this on the podcast before, but testing and how psychology and testing and standardized tests all interlock to like feed into systemic racism. And then I was like, oh my God, it's all connected. And my brain was just like, I can't like connect all of this. And I got really overwhelmed. But one of the reasons I wanted to have you on was just because we've had conversations about eating disorders on the podcast. We've had, I think, 3 at this point. It's something that I personally am, my most recent healing journey, I think. I've been working on trauma healing for the last 5 years, but the eating disorder thing is the most recent for me. And despite it being probably the thing that I've been dealing with the longest, and I think that culturally, mental health has really become something that people talk a lot about. It's become something that is very welcomed in spaces, and obviously, I don't think we're quite at where we need to be, but we're much further than we used to be in terms of like progress. However, eating disorders are a part of mental health and they get left out of the conversation a lot. And then there's obviously been lots of conversation about diet culture and fat phobia and how media is really harmful when it comes to how we view bodies. But then simultaneously, the actual logistics of eating disorders and what they look like and like how they intersect with other forms of life and how things like food deserts can actually impact having disordered eating and all of these different things, those don't really get talked about on a mainstream platform very often. And you kind of just have the classic, like, love your body. And like, that's kind of it. And there's not a lot of the actual logistics behind it. And so that was one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on, was just like, okay, well, let's get into some of the nitty gritty of it that doesn't get talked about, that in my opinion, understanding the nitty gritty and understanding how everything intersects is equally as important as preaching the conversation of like all bodies are good bodies and kind of having that base narrative and fighting against diet cultures and acknowledging that diets are not healthy. That's all really important. But I think that when we don't get into the actual root issues of why people are still suffering from eating disorders and what's causing that and what's leading to it, then it's kind of, we're just circular talking of like, love your body, but like, no one's going to like teach you how to like, you know, no one's going to explain how to do that or how all these other things impact how you can get food that is good for you or that helps you feel empowered, or it's just, it all gets lost in the noise a little bit.
So with all that being said, the first kind of thing we have on our docket here is just a kind of general question. For people who maybe are listening and are feeling like very confused, it's like, okay, how do other things even impact eating disorders? How does that even cross over? What's kind of a general answer of like, why is it important to look at eating disorders and how they intersect with other like social and human rights issues?
Yeah.
Just generally, like a little crash course.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so important to look at the whole person. There is so much more to us than just if somebody has an eating disorder, if somebody is struggling with disordered eating. And I think exactly like you're saying, a lot of the messages that we hear are very like blanket statements. They're very black and white. But what works for one person is not going to work for another person. So by just looking at somebody's eating disorder, we're missing so much nuance. We're missing so much about the person in terms of how did they get to this point? What are some other factors that we need to help them work on to be able to help them in their recovery with their eating disorder. There's so many things like that come to my mind when I'm talking about this. When you talk about religion, I also grew up in a Christian household. I grew up non-denominational. I think I would still describe myself as Christian, non-denominational. The way I practice is definitely different than how it was for me growing up. I don't really go to church that often anymore. If I do, I'm just watching on YouTube and not really paying attention to it. But in the church, there is so much talk about dieting. There's so much talk about how we should be looking. I know my pastor talks all the time about exercising and gaining muscle and all of these things and how everybody should be quote unquote like thin. And that's the way that, you know, when people talk about honoring your body is a temple to the Lord. Like that is saying, oh, you need to be thin. That is the only way to honor your body and be presentable to the Lord. So I think when we are talking about eating disorders and we're not talking about the facts that these are messages that have been talked about, to these folks throughout their lives, we're missing so many points that need to be discussed.
Yeah. We didn't even have religion on our outline, but I've talked about that before, about specifically the body as a temple thing, because I think the only time that really gets used is talking about food, talking about alcohol, talking about smoking, and talking about tattoos. Those are like the four main ones. And there's such a weird, like underlying, I don't know. There's a very like fat phobic underlying thread, I think, through a lot of American evangelical churches. And it's not outright. It's not like they're waving signs that are saying like fat people don't deserve to be here, like they do with like you know, homophobia and queerphobia. Yeah. But there is this kind of underlying thread where you don't see quite as much representation. There, a lot of the worship leaders are very, like stereotypically like thin people in very small bodies. And, a lot of white people, a lot of like white, cisgendered, straight, thin people. And so it's not necessarily that there's like this outright, talk about the fact that like fatness is a sin, but it's kind of assumed. And, you're also, as a child growing up in that environment, a huge part of life and understanding other people's experiences is simply exposure to those people and seeing them also getting the same opportunities. And I think that it starts to kind of create these neural connections in young minds of like, oh, well, that means the people that deserve to have a platform and be up on stage and have leadership are primarily men. And if there are women, they are thin, conventionally attractive, straight, white, cisgendered women. And so even if there's not this like blatant rejection of fatness, it's still assumed. And then simultaneously, you have kind of all these little weird underlying like digs and little comments about even just the typical diet culture commentary of just like, oh, I like ate too much ice cream. I should have done that. There's like all that kind of weird underlying like conversation that happens in just small groups and conversation around the church, but also from the pulpit. And it's one of those things where I had someone ask me at one point when I was doing a deconstruction episode, like, well, how is the church fat phobic? And I was like, I don't even have like a straight answer to give you. It's just like, if you walk in, you can kind of feel it. Yeah. I don't know how to tell you other than like, it's kind of a vibe. Yeah. Like, you kind of just can feel the vibe. And it's just, there's a lot of that. And, so I'm just going to kind of go through, we have some different topics that are kind of human rights issues or different, even just different demographics and different situations that just relate to contributing, to disordered eating. And it's not even necessarily that it's, once again, this is all very intersectional and very nuanced. So it's not that there's a straight pipeline from this X to, you know, or A to B or whatever, where it's like, if you have this situation, you're immediately going to get an eating disorder. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a ton of different variables that don't necessarily set someone up in a way where they have the resources or the preparation to not have disordered eating and to be taught to not see their body as the enemy, and kind of it's more so just the setup compared to like it being a direct pipeline. But we can start with income and how just different income demographics can impact someone's susceptibility to disordered eating. And on the flip side of that, kind of, you know, same coin, food deserts. And maybe if you want to explain what food deserts are for people who aren't aware.
Sure. Yeah. So I actually want to push back on the term food deserts a little bit and think about it in a way of, I guess, renaming it to something that is not man-made, right? So deserts are something that is not naturally occurring. So deserts are naturally occurring. I keep saying nationally. They're naturally occurring.
No, you're fine.
Deserts are naturally occurring, whereas food apartheids are man-made. So the language, the language is moving more towards using the term food apartheid versus food desert now. The reason that it is man-made is because it's coming from colonialism. It's coming from like back in the beginning of America when slaves were brought to the country. And what we're seeing now that's happening is there are two separate, I guess, places in one area. So you'll have one place that is white, rich, affluent, and then right across across the street down the way, you'll have another area that is mostly brown, poor. Incomes are vastly different. So maybe you have an income that's like 25K and the other income is around like 80K. So what's happening is in these food apartheids, they're not having access to grocery stores. They don't have access to a lot of things that people in the other area would have access to. They can't afford cars. They can't afford transportation to get themselves from point A to point B. So what we'll end up seeing is five of the same grocery store in the white affluent area and only corner stores, only bodegas in the other area with the people who have lower income. So in order to get to that area, they are either having to walk long distances, they're either having to drive if they do have a car, but it takes them a while to get there. They don't have the money to be able to afford what is in these grocery stores either, because a lot of the time they're things like Whole Foods, they're things like Trader Joe's, and they have fresh fruits and vegetables, whereas in the corner stores and the bodegas, it's mostly like quote unquote like processed food, like easy ready to make food, frozen food. Right. And that is looked at as bad. That's looked at as bad quality for those people to be eating those foods. Whereas if somebody goes to Trader Joe's, Trader Joe's has a ton of frozen meals. And because it's Trader Joe's, those are seen as like quote unquote healthy for those people. Mm-hmm. Right. But if somebody is eating frozen food on the other side, then they're bad. They're not doing it right. They're unhealthy. So that is kind of how food apartheids are made. And also when grocery stores are looking where to put their stores, they look at income. So if they see, okay, these people's income is around 25K, we're not going to put our grocery stores there because they're not going to be able to afford our food. So then they put them on the other side where there are already five of the same store, but they know that those people make more money. They're going to be able to afford the food. So we blame the people on the other side for the health disparities that they have. We blame them if they have diabetes, if they have heart issues, if they have all of these things, whereas it is a systemic issue. It's a racism issue. It has nothing to do with them. So when somebody doesn't have access to income, when somebody doesn't have access to food, a lot of the time what could happen is that restrict cycle, the binge restrict cycle. But in this case, it's they're restricting because they don't have access to food. They don't have enough money to get the food that they need. Or they're not having a good variety of food that could help keep them full throughout the day. So they're eating, but they're still hungry. So what ends up happening is they could end up binging later on. And then that leads to how the eating disorder starts. And then it's a cycle and the food scarcity mindset of, I'm not going to get food again. So while I have food right now, I'm going to eat as much as I can before it goes away.
Yeah. And that's I think a thing about eating disorders as well, that seems to be, I think, generally misunderstood by the public, is the idea that if you have an eating disorder, it is in turn, hand in hand with diet culture, in terms of like, you want to diet. And that's the whole goal, is just to lose weight and to be thin, and that's the entire goal. And I think that I've learned in my own journey that it started that way for me. And for what, like 7 years, that was the truth. And then I started addressing the problem and still had really intense disordered eating and a pretty raging eating disorder, like still. And my mindset was entirely different. And it wasn't at all I'm not eating because I want to lose weight. It was I'm not eating because I'm so used to not prioritizing food, because that's been my habit for 7 years. And so it's just not a priority for me. And so I would forget to eat, or I would just not make it a priority. If I had a ton of things to do, I wouldn't eat first. I would do those things first. And then now it's 2 o'clock and I haven't eaten. And so it just became I still was living in those exact same eating disorder habits, but the intention was different. And simultaneously with the food scarcity aspect, that I saw this in real life this week, which is always kind of an interesting crossover when I have a podcast and I have like a real life experience of it. Because I think that some people assume that food apartheid and food scarcity happens maybe only in small towns, or maybe it's like, oh, well, maybe they just don't have the space or the funds to have, you know, a nice store. And so I was in a really small town this week, and their local grocery store just shut down. And it's a relatively rich area. It's like a waterfront town. And so very small, very small. We're talking like one store, like one little tiny locally owned like pet store,
oh,
and
wow,
like one barber in the entire town, and like one gas station. Like, it's very small.
Wow.
However, the grocery store shut down. It was a local grocery store. And there are talks that it's getting replaced with the Whole Foods. And so it's not the small town. Like, it's not like, oh, they don't want to come to the small towns because they're too small. It's like, no, they know it's a rich small town with a lot of people who literally have like yachts. So it's like, it doesn't matter that it's small. It's the rich area. And so even though it's a small town, they're still going to get better food than maybe a really big town down the street that has lower income, mm-hmm, because it is in an area where it's a very weird area where you drive 30 minutes south and the income threshold is significantly different. And yet it's a way bigger town. And so this tiny, tiny, tiny small town that has, I think, like 2,000 people or something crazy like that, like very small. The whole little area is like maybe 7 miles straight through. Like, it's tiny.
Wow.
And it's kind of country, waterfront, rich. They're getting this really nice grocery store. And then you've got a town 30 minutes south that's big, really big. And it's also it's a port town. And so it has a lot of employment, a lot of people passing through. then you don't have that access to the same food. Mm-hmm. You have almost exclusively like Safeways and Albertsons, which even though those are still grocery stores, you have the really nice organic grocery store going into the very, very small town, but the rich small town.
Yeah.
And so I saw that this week and I remembered, I was thinking ahead to the fact that we were recording and I was like, I'm watching this play out in real time. But it's very interesting because it's all very strategic. Capitalism is extremely strategic.
Oh yeah.
But yeah. And then I guess this is a hand in hand issue, but the next one we have on our list here is racial oppression. And how can this contribute to one's susceptibility to disordered eating?
Yeah, I think this is definitely, I mean, these are all big topics, but this is definitely a very big topic. BIPOC, Black, Brown, Indigenous people of color are often looked at as like other. They're looked at as in America and also other countries as well, but we're not the standard of beauty in America. We're not the standard of health, of education. So in some cases, this can lead to folks needing to achieve higher. And I say needing to versus wanting to, because it is actually a need for them. They need to be, they need to fit in. They need to do whatever they need to do in order to survive. Like, this can actually be a survival skill for them. So they end up pushing themselves really hard. They end up maybe dieting, doing whatever it is they need to do to be able to fit in this country. And I know I've seen that firsthand in my family. My parents are both from Haiti. And my mom came here when she was young. She was probably like 3, but my dad came here when he was at the end of his high school education. So more so in my dad, I always see the need to fit in, the need to look a certain way. My dad talks about exercising constantly. He talks about eating like he tells me how I'm supposed to eat. I'm like, I'm a dietitian. Like, you don't need to tell me what to do. He's like, he tells me I need to change my eating habits all the time because I need to lose weight. I need to look thin. I need to fit in. Actually, not even fit in, just not stand out, right? Because we already stand out with our skin color. Let's focus on something that we can actually control so we don't stand out any more than we actually need to. So I think I see that a lot of times with BIPOC when I'm seeing them as clients and they're not wanting to stand out. They're straddling the line of wanting to achieve the American standard of beauty and also still wanting to achieve their own standard of beauty in their culture. So I know for Black folks, it's very like big butt. Big, I guess like the hourglass figure type of thing, like Kim Kardashian type of look for Black folks. And then for Americans, it's thin. I guess that's basically it, just thin. So people are wanting to either get thin and fit in with Eurocentric American ideals, or they're also wondering, should they look the way that other Black folks are looking so they fit in on that side? Because there is colorism in Black culture. There is, I mean, Black people have called me like white before because of the way I speak, because of the way I do live my life. So there is also that to consider when trying to figure out like, what am I actually supposed to do? So that can also show up as restricting to lose weight. It can show up as binging. It can show up as all the different types of eating disorders in one person, because they're like constantly towing the line and wondering, what am I supposed to actually be doing? Who am I supposed to look like right now?
Yeah. And I think the thing that's interesting, we're going to go through a few more of these, but every single one of them disproportionately affects Brown and Black people, like specifically in America. Every single one of them is disproportionately affecting them. And so I think the interesting thing, even from the perspective of the food deserts and the income, you know, like we know that Black and Brown people often have less access to income, and are and that often is perpetuated by the educational system and the policing system and jails. And I mean, there's so many things that can influence income. But then you also have the food desert, or I'm sorry, food apartheid aspect. And specifically the fast food aspect, because you've got, a lot of fast food restaurants will be placed in areas that, are lower income, because it's the idea that, well, we'll give you the really cheap food. And then you have politicians, getting on stands and talking about the fact that we have this obesity crisis and it's terrible to idealize being fat. And you have them attacking people like Lizzo, who is arguably the number one, like representative of just accepting your body and loving your body, and all bodies are good bodies. I think she has like literally drastically changed the entire narrative there. And blew apart so many stereotypes. Cause I was seeing some articles recently about the fact that there have been other, people who, represent fatness and, kind of become representatives of, dismantling fat phobia and loving fat bodies. And, then they often will lose weight. And then it's kind of like then fat people are like, ah, wait, like you were who I looked up to and you were my role model. And now I feel like I have to, like, do I have to lose weight? Cause yeah. You did it. And people have like really applauded Lizzo for just like owning the shit out of it. And then you have politicians getting up and tearing her down and saying, are we really idealizing being fat and being unhealthy? And you have all those narratives. And once again, it's all coming back to, it just keeps coming down on Black and Brown people, like over and over and over and over and over again, because we've got the food apartheid and the fact that a lot of people, only have access to fast food. And so then they're the ones that are eating it. And then it's like, well, you're the one who's contributing to the obesity crisis. And it's like, well, can we pause? Because can we acknowledge the fact that y'all are the ones who are setting this whole thing up? You're setting it up. You're putting the restaurants. And I'm not saying that like there's one politician that's like the conspiracy theorist that's doing all of it, but it's a system that works together. And you're the one building the system, promoting the system, enabling the system, funding the system. And then you're pointing your fingers at the people who are just living in the system.
Mm-hmm.
Who had nothing to do with the creation or the funding or the enabling of it. And then you're saying, you're the problem. Yep. Like, you're the reason that we have this crisis, and you're the reason that we're idealizing fatness, and that's gross and we shouldn't be doing that. And it's like, hang on. Like, what the fuck did they do? Yeah. They didn't do anything wrong. And once again, it's disproportionately affecting Black and Brown people. You don't see a lot of that. You don't see a lot of the fingers being pointed at white fat people. You see a lot of the fingers being pointed at Black and Brown fat people. And so it's just, again, all of it is, it's all this, like I said, whenever I talk about intersectionality, my mind short circuits just a little bit, because it's so deeply interconnected that I'm like, I can't even cope with how much it all is connected. But, every single thing on this list that we're going to talk about disproportionately affects Black and Brown people significantly.
Yeah.
Like way more than white fat individuals. Way, 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 way more. So with that being said, the next one we have family situations, family dynamics, how you might grow up, how your family might view food, bodies, et cetera. How can that impact someone's susceptibility to eating disorders, or even just kind of how they are almost like groomed to view their body and food as they grow up?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. I think similar to what I was sharing before with my dad, in that, my dad was teaching me growing up that I needed to look a certain way in order to be okay in the world in America. I know even farther than talking just about weight, even talking about my hair. I had a whole conversation, a very lengthy conversation with my dad when I decided I didn't want to have a relaxer anymore. And relaxer is when it straightens your hair. And I wanted to have natural hair instead. And it was like, people can just go to the hair salon and say that they want to cut their hair and they make it like a 5-minute decision. It was like, I was talking about it forever. Just the fact that I wanted to cut my hair because of how I could be treated differently in the world. So I think especially, and this is a very like broad generalized statement, but especially with people who have parents who are immigrants, I think that they see this a lot more often, being from another country and trying to make themselves in America, whatever that looks like for them. They're trying to do as much as they can. They're trying to achieve so much so that they are able to, like, quote unquote, like, become someone and live the American dream. And that often looks like dieting. That often looks like disordered eating, diet culture, like whatever it looks like, changing your body in order to not stand out and just be a part of the crowd in America. I think also just family situations, in terms of maybe you have a parent who is in jail, or maybe you have a parent who is doing whatever. You grew up as in a single family home. It could just be more chaotic as well. So somebody who may feel like they don't have control of what's going on in their lives will turn to disordered eating, will turn to an eating disorder, because that is something they do have control over. They have control over of how they look. They have control over their weight, what they're eating. So when somebody doesn't have control over one situation, they can find another situation to make sure they do have that control.
Yeah. And obviously then additionally, you have the people that, their parents have eating disorders, mm-hmm. or are really enveloped in diet culture. And then that just kind of gets passed down. Because I think in general, the conversation about diet culture, like being really mainstream and actually having representation, probably is only about 5 years old. Like, it's a pretty recent conversation. It hasn't been super mainstream for very long. And so you have generations and generations and generations of parents who were taught that they're not supposed to like feed their body. And even just from the restriction perspective, like they're not supposed to feed their body when it's hungry. They're only supposed mm-hmm. to feed their body a certain amount to maintain a certain shape and size. And then if that's the only food pattern that you know, and that's only like nutrition pattern that you know, it makes sense that that would be kind of either directly passed down to your children by how you choose to feed them, because you're the one monitoring their food intake, or kind of passed down simply by representation and by leading by example, where your kid is small and they like to mimic and they're just watching mom or dad restrict and not, you know, eat a few almonds yeah. as like a lunch. And then the kids just pick up on that. And I, pretty much every girl I know my age, all of my friends, like we all have that experience with our parents. Like everybody has like a extremely similar experience of like, yeah, like there were like Atkins bars all over my house, or there were like South Beach diet bars. And like, that was part of our snack. And like, it's so common, especially that wave of like early 2000s, diet programs with the infomercials and mm-hmm. the kind of skinny renaissance with like Nicole Richie and Paris Hilton, and like the skinniness being like the absolute goal, and the low rise jeans. And you've got all that perfectly kind of in a perfect storm coming together with marketing improving and different, like the internet really popping off. And you've got like all these things that kind of created this perfect storm of diet culture that was really raging from like 2000 to like 2015. And obviously far before that as well, but just, I think the internet and the way that marketing shifted was like, here's a perfect storm to just create like eating disorders in everyone.
Yeah.
And then obviously from like a separate side of that, you have family situations of just, maybe not having access to food. And then perhaps you're restricting, like you said, out of need. And then you just start to build, associations between food, that it's like, well, I can only eat if I if I really need to eat and I'm feeling starving compared to like, I'm just eating when I'm hungry. It gets to that point of just needing like survival mode, just being in like absolutely like pure survival mode. And then to your point of the fitting in, I think the thing additionally is America is not set up in a way that is like welcoming to people. It is basically set up in a way that it's like, you either have to assimilate to our culture or we don't want you here.
Yeah.
And so it's not set up in a way that's celebratory of other people's backgrounds, or not even just celebratory, like doesn't even really tolerate it. Cause I think celebratory would be the next stage of like, yay, we love diversity and different differences between people and like cultural diversity. We're not even close to that. We haven't even hit like tolerance. And so there was a book, and I'm not going to plug the book cause I haven't read it. But there's a book titled Assimilator Go Home. And it wasn't saying that that's what you should do. It was a conversation about how, America, and specifically when it comes to immigration and having people come from different cultural backgrounds, it's not set up for people to come as they are and just be who they are in America. It's set up that either you assimilate or you go back to where you came from. Like that's the setup. And so obviously that can apply to every aspect of life, but in this conversation of food, it's also going to apply to that, where if you're trying to assimilate to a certain body type and match that and fit in, and you know, there's certain things like you have your body settles at a natural weight, and maybe the weight you're trying to get to is not your natural weight, and so you're having to do all of these things to try to shrink yourself when that's just really not a natural point for your body to be at, and your body keeps kind of trying to go back to that natural like set point for you. And so then you're trying to restrict more, and you're trying diet pills, and you're trying like all these things just to try to like fight against the fact that your body wasn't really built to be that size. And that's not a bad thing. It's just different. And because it's different in America, that normally means it's bad.
It's bad. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think also in this conversation too, is in terms of assimilation, it is also assimilating into the different types of foods that we're eating. So
yeah,
Black Southern food is always seen as bad. Mexican food is seen as bad. Any type of food that's not like a traditional American food or Italian food is seen as bad, which makes no sense because they're the same ingredients, just made different ways, and they're bad for us. So we'll see a lot that people are rejecting their culture in so many ways. And especially with food, I've had patients who have never eaten their cultural foods in their lives, which is really sad. And then they also have a fear to start eating those foods because of, I guess, accepting their culture and what that would mean for them. But then when we see things like Cinco de Mayo or any other holiday, people are like, oh my God, I love Mexican food. It's the best thing. Or Taco Bell. Taco Bell isn't Mexican food. Like we have in America a very strange way of accepting different cultures. It's only when we want to do it. It's only when we deem it's appropriate. Every other time it's like, okay, like you said, it's like, okay, go away. Like we don't want you here if you're not going to be assimilating to the way we do things here.
Yeah. And I think it's also like, when people can find it profitable, because, I just looked at the CEO of Taco Bell and it's a white man.
Of course it is.
So you got that. So it's like, you can whitewash it. And it's an old white man. Mm-hmm. Also, I'd like to clarify that, you can whitewash it. And if you can profit off of it, then it's fine.
Yep.
And I mean, similarly, like I'm looking up CEOs of just like, we got a white CEO of Taco Time. We do have a Asian CEO of Panda Express. Cause I was curious about that.
Okay.
So props to them. Love that. But yeah, you've got a lot of different, it seems like the way that America accepts other cultures is if they can profit off of it.
Yeah.
Because if it's not profitable, then it's not. And that, I think that's, from the side of the food being bad, you have the whole conversation about like MSG and Chinese food.
Yeah.
And that whole like conversation that was talking about, oh, it's bad for you and it's horrible. And like, ah, and like literally I for years just thought that MSG was like the worst thing in the world for you and that it was so bad. And it wasn't until I hit like my 20s that I was like, oh, it was racism. Like, cool. Like, it's actually not really like much different than like salt.
Yeah.
Like it. And I was just like, okay, like, cool. That was just a literal racist like campaign to shut down someone else's culture. Like, awesome. And I was just like, I just had accepted that. And so there's shit like that, that if you don't look into it and it's just kind of like colloquially, that's just like the way everyone thinks about it. And you don't look into the history of that and you don't do the research and you kind of just hear it, even like playground talk. And that sounds kind of silly, but if you hear it in like just a casual school environment or a work environment and you're kind of just like, oh, like, okay. And that can just kind of solidify in your brain. And you have no idea that the roots of that are inherently racist. This is not a racist thing, but it's similar in my head of like, I grew up in a Christian school and they told us that we had one less rib than men. Fun fact, that's a bold ass lie. And I went my entire life thinking that that was legit because God took a rib from men, or that men have one less rib than us, whatever the narrative is, but that somebody had one less rib. I did not find out that that was false until last year. And I called my dad and I was like, excuse me, did you know this was a lie? Because you told me. And he goes, no, I didn't know that was a lie. And he was like, wow. Are you sure? And I was like, yeah, literally look it up. And he was like, oh, that's weird. Like, that's a weird thing that just became like folklore almost like in the Christian environment. And it was just a bold ass lie. And so there's these kind of things that you can just accept because you don't think to look into them. Mm-hmm. And so many of the narratives around other cultures and their food really do not have a factual basis. It's genuinely just things that somebody came up with, normally from some sort of racist root, and it spread like a wildfire and nobody fact checked it.
Yep.
It was just kind of like, okay, I'll just accept that that's the truth. When in reality it's truly just racism. Like that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. Cultural foods is something that it gets me so mad. I often tell my patients that you need to just eat the things that you want to be eating, especially when it comes to, so I also work in an eating disorder treatment center. So what we do is we have menus that we ask the patients to follow every week, and we put like what foods we want them to follow. And for breakfast, we always have the most traditionally American breakfast cereal, pancakes, granola and yogurt, like all of the boring breakfast that we have in America. But there are some people who eat rice for breakfast. There are people who eat noodles. There are people who eat a bunch of different types of things for breakfast. But in this program, they're not allowed to bring those things into program. They're not allowed to eat them because they're not on the menu. So we're also, even in eating, so we have issues with eating disorders in general, the intersectionality in terms of eating disorders, but also if those people are able to get into treatment, they're not getting inclusive care. They're not able to talk about their intersectional identities. They're not able to eat their cultural foods. There's just so many things that are wrong with that. And also, even if they do get in, there have income issues as well, which I didn't talk about before, but I think I actually saw this post on Instagram this morning, so it also worked out that we were recording today. So it was from Project Heal, and they said that according to the University of California, San Diego, the average eating disorder treatment episode costs $80,000. So that's eating disorder treatment center, that's outpatient care with a therapist, a dietitian, and a lot of people aren't even just having one episode of treatment. A lot of people have to go to treatment multiple times as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I've looked into eating disorder treatment because I was like, this shit is bad. And I have been dealing with this for a very long time. And the other thing that doesn't get talked about is how long remission can take. It is like the remission can be like, it'd be like 10 years. Like remission mm-hmm. for eating disorders is long, and like people can relapse because it's such a food is like the core of people's being. It's one of the primary survival needs. You have like water, food, and shelter, really. Like those are like primary, like primal needs. And so it's so built into you, and it can be so easy in a world that does not support healthy thinking surrounding food. And I don't mean healthy in the sense of like keto. I mean healthy as in actually viewing food as something to just like, and some people don't love the whole like food fuels you narrative. For me, it's always really clicked in my brain that like I'm not viewing food as good or bad. And it's just kind of a neutral, like, no, I need this to survive. So if I'm hungry, I need to eat because it will fuel my body. And then I can do good things with my brain. And then I can give, and same thing with the kind of almost neutral view of my body of not that my body looks good or looks bad, but that like my body gives really good hugs. And like, I am able to eat food and then I'm able to go and walk my dog. And that's a thing that I like to do. And just viewing it as more so what can come out of it than inherently being good or bad. And there's often, like the treatment options are so limited and so expensive. Mm-hmm. I looked into it and I was like, okay, there's no way in hell I can ever afford that. I'll do it on my own, I guess. Like that's fine. And even insurance, like covering it, like it's, there's a lot of like my insurance didn't cover. I was looking into what my insurance would cover. My insurance didn't cover any type of eating disorder treatment program. And I have a relatively primary like insurance. It's not like it's one of the like, you know, big 10 or whatever. So it's one of the bigger ones, and it still didn't cover anything. And it's the accessibility to, and then we go back to accessibility to Whole Foods and accessibility mm-hmm. to even methods of cooking or, and then you've got the intersectionality, which we can go into this next about mental health. And you've got, well, what if you have an eating disorder and you also have raging depression and maybe you don't have the energy or the mental space to cook? What about meal delivery programs? Those are expensive. What about hiring a cook? That's out of the question. What about, you know what I mean? It's like there's mm-hmm. there's so many different, the financial aspect of it is just unreal. And then you go back to, well, who has the income? Well, the white men primarily have yeah. the income. And so it's like, okay, well then what about the fact that all of this is disproportionately affecting Black and brown people? Well, they're not going to get the resources because they don't have the primary income. Mm-hmm. It's the white people that have the income, primarily the white cis straight men. So it's just this like lovely merry-go-round of trauma and disordered eating and harm with, honestly, like a lot of kind of Band-Aid-esque solutions, because even mm-hmm. even some of the solutions, it's so systemic that some of the solutions don't do too much, if that makes sense. Because in order to actually fix it, you got to like dig it up from
yeah.
the roots. And the only people who can do that are the white straight men
yeah.
who don't really want to do it. So it's like, okay, well, how the hell do we make this work? And so with that being said, do we want to kind of end on mental health and mental health care access and how that can contribute to like susceptibility when it comes to eating disorders?
Sure. And I also wanted to add, when it comes to treatment centers and the accessibility of it, also ableism. People might not be able to even get to the treatment center. People might not be able to do the things that we ask them to do in order to get the treatment that they need. So also adding that a little bit to the conversation. But when I think of mental health, healthcare access, I also think of the talk of mental health in a lot of families, which when it comes to a lot of Black and brown families and BIPOC in general, there is limited talk about mental health. I know I've heard a lot. I think when I was growing up, we never talked about mental health at all. We never talked about depression. We never talked about anxiety. And my family is very highly anxious. I'm like, nobody ever described it as that. It was just like, okay, this is what's happening. And that's what it is. But I know I've heard a lot of patients will tell me, well, we don't even have a word in our language for mental health. We don't have a word in our language for eating disorders. It's not something that anybody knows about or is talked about. And it's very stigmatizing in a lot of different cultures, families, because if you need mental health treatment, it means like the parents did something wrong. It's a lot of the time that's what it's seen as. The parents didn't raise you correctly. You need mental health treatment because of they failed in their duties. So it's very stigmatizing. A lot of the time people will say, oh, well, you just need to pray about it. You just need to go to church. You just need to do the things you do and then God's going to fix it and everything's going to go away. You're going to be all better, or any other type of solution that there is for that. So yeah, mental health is how can people even get the care that they need when it's not talked about in their families and they aren't even able to describe what is happening for them.
Yeah. And simultaneously with that, like early intervention for anything is ideal. And so if you're in a household where maybe it's a genetic thing with your mental illness, like maybe it's something that you've been suffering from age six. And if there's not the open conversation, there's not the open channels for communication of expressing either how it's affecting you, expressing to your parents that you even have a problem and that you're suffering from something. Cause there can be the kind of be strong narrative where it's just not a safe space to talk about it. That also removes any early intervention. Cause then you're a child, you don't have the funds to like send yourself to therapy. And so if your parents aren't, open to the conversation, that removes the early intervention. Then you have the additional, maybe your parents don't have healthcare. Maybe they have healthcare, maybe their healthcare doesn't extend to mental healthcare. Maybe they don't have a car to get you to therapy. Maybe they don't have a laptop for virtual therapy. There's like so many different things that can go into that, even if there is the open dialogue. And even the open dialogue often nowadays comes from education, comes from access to education, comes from access to the internet. Like there's a lot of different things where even getting to a point where you have the education about mental health and what mental health looks like and what healthcare looks like for mental health, once again, comes back to if you don't have access to XYZ, you can't really get to the point where you're actually being taken care of with your mental health. And the system doesn't set you up to have access to XYZ. And so we're back to square one. And obviously that's why there are organizations and different nonprofits that focus primarily on Black and brown individuals and getting them free therapy and getting them free mental health resources. There have been so many Black and brown creators on social media that have created free support groups and free like Zoom meetups and online courses and all these kind of things entirely for free to try to just like lessen that gap to some extent. But then you kind of we're back to the same point of like, it's fantastic that they're doing that, but they shouldn't have to not be paid for their labor and their work simply to compensate for the gap that they didn't create and are also suffering from. And so it's like, okay, well, like, once again, and it's an okay Band-Aid solution, but it's not a solution that's actually getting to the root of the problem. And it's still a solution that is disproportionately affecting Black and brown people, because the people who are often creating those therapy funds and those support groups and those free resources are almost exclusively Black and brown women. And so you're putting that on them. Or they're taking it up themselves. Either way, they're not the ones who created the system that created that need, but yet they're still the ones that are having to fulfill it without financial compensation. And so, you know, I mean, more than props to them, like so much respect for them for filling that gap and trying to like help people and give them resources when they're not getting compensated back. I mean, that's incredibly selfless and kind and thoughtful and important, but they shouldn't have to be doing that. And that's the gist of the problem, is it shouldn't have to be a thing. Even though the fact that it is a thing is yay, like go you, but you shouldn't have to be doing this. And so it's all just so cyclical. And with all that being said, it's very cyclical, it's very systemic, and that can be really discouraging. What would you say to someone as how they can help, I guess? Like, what would be action steps? Because obviously, it's probably pretty unlikely that there are very high sitting politicians listening to this podcast that can actually make a change. And so for those of us who are just normal humans feeling really discouraged by the intersectionality of it all and how much it all connects, because that can be really discouraging, where it's just like, oh God, there's so many problems and I have no power to fix any of them. What do I do? So what would your advice be to someone listening to this, almost feeling overwhelmed of how can I help?
Yeah. My advice would be to, one, continue to educate yourself, listen to more podcasts, do whatever you need to do, but just talk about it. I think having conversations, even if it's just with your friend or your family, the more people who are talking about it, the more people are who are going to actually learn about it and want to make a difference, right? It starts with one person, one conversation, and it can become big. Go on Instagram, go on TikTok, share the profiles of people who are already talking about it. And if you are able to, pay them for what their work. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of providers or a lot of people doing the work will have things in their whatever the link is in their bio.
Yeah, like Linktree or
whatever. Yeah, Linktree of like buy me a coffee or they have their Venmo in there. Like if you're able to do that, but otherwise just have conversations about it.
Yeah, and to add on to that, I have some resources in on my website, so mindfulmindspod.com. There are some resources specifically for Black and Brown mental health. And they're obviously resources, initially they're there for Black and Brown people who need mental health support. But if you are someone who is looking to financially compensate, there are a lot of resources that are traditionally like free that you could then go. And I guarantee that almost all of those nonprofits, organizations, individuals have ways to compensate them. I know for a fact some of them do because I've looked into it myself. And then simultaneously, if you have parts in your budget for charity or for giving and things to kind of like want to have that chunk of your income to give back to people, I would really highly recommend giving to individuals or really, really small organizations, because the bigger ones are the ones that get the more like notoriety and the publicity. And so if you can find the smaller ones and find the individuals where you're putting money directly in someone's pocket and compensating them for what they're doing, that's probably better in the long run in terms of actually making individual change in someone's life, compared to like, I'm all for Planned Parenthood. I've stopped giving to Planned Parenthood simply because I know that so many people do. And it's like, I've started to look at, you know, smaller abortion care networks and figuring out just how to get money on the ground. Simply because Planned Parenthood is like a household name. People know what Planned Parenthood is. They don't need my publicity. You know what I mean? So it's like, let's give to Midwest Access Coalition and all these other little small ones that need the care and are boots on the ground. And so simultaneously do that with mental health. Try to find, ways to, And same thing with eating disorders. Do find the intersectional organizations that are really, really small and try to give to them if you can, because I think that does more work in the long run. And then publicize it. Like not your giving, but publicize the people that you're giving to, and let people know, hey, these people need support and they need donations. Because like I said, whenever there's that lovely social media blow up where a cause gets really promoted, whatever that cause might be. Recently it's been abortion, and we've got the Roe v. Wade, and we had a lot of Planned Parenthoods being tossed around. And it was like, a lot of people were like, hey, give to the smaller organizations. Planned Parenthood is chill. They're good. Like give to the smaller organizations. Yeah. And so try to, if you can, also publicize it and because some people might not know. They might not know that there are small organizations that need assistance, or even just individuals. So try to find the not even the underdogs, because they're doing the same work. They're just not getting the publicity.
Yeah.
So try to find those people. And with all that being said, I want to give you a space, because you are a person coming on the podcast and doing free labor. Where can people compensate you? Where can people find you? Do you have a way to donate? Do you have a way for people to continue to follow your content and promote you and give your page publicity?
Yeah, I currently do not have a way to donate to me, but if you want to follow me on Instagram, my handle is at thecelestiallife.rd, or my website is thecelestiallife.com. If you want to work with me, I am Black, I'm cisgender. I have my own private practice where I work with people who struggle with disordered eating disorders, but also a variety of other like medical things. So like diabetes, heart health, but I practice from an anti-diet weight inclusive lens. So if you don't want to be told to lose weight to help heal whatever issue you have, then come on over and work with me if you want to. I also do take I'm in Connecticut. I also do take insurance in Connecticut at healingspringswellnesscenter.com, I believe is the website. So if you have insurance and you want to work with me that way, then I'll be over there too.
Perfect. Well, I will put all of that in the description. And I will also make a little resources page for some of the things that we've talked about, some accounts to follow for more intersectional eating disorder content. And yours is a fantastic, and will be, I'll promote that first and foremost.
Thank you.
And then I'll also kind of give some resources for mental health and for all of this kind of intersectional, all these intersectional topics that we've talked about that, like I said, it can be overwhelming, but if you have the income to support people, I'll put some places where you can. And if not, at least give them a follow, give some publicity, give Brianna some publicity, promote her content, you know, try to do what you can with the tools and the resources that you can, or that you have rather. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on and for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please rate us 5 stars on iTunes and leave us a review. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram at MindfulMindsPod with our new username and visit us online at MindfulMindsPod.com and SerafinaBlog.com. You can also follow us on TikTok at Fina_Bina, that's spelled FINA_BINA for deconstruction content, and at MindfulMindsPodcast for all the podcast clips. And as always, to end our time, unclench your jaw, take a deep breath, and remember, you can always learn, you can always grow, and you can always choose to live your life in a more mindful way. I will chat with you guys in 2 weeks.